everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2023, and you're listening to episode 348, which is a conversation about some major news in the Anglican Church. Today's guest is Anne Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People. Anne blogs about current events and theological trends at standfirminfaith.com and on her Substack, Demotivations with Anne. Anne has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called Despair and Hope in the Anglican Communion. You can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. Anne, it's good to have you on again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's been a while since the Christian Research Journal has covered news. In fact, news was a staple for many decades as part of the coverage that we did in the Christian Research Journal. But of course, the internet was invented and news gets out there pretty quickly. So it didn't really make sense to keep using it as an integral part of the print magazine. However, we still want to cover newsworthy events in Christendom. And such events have occurred recently within the Anglican Communion. Now, there are probably a lot of our listeners that are not from a more historical or liturgical branch of Christianity, either in a tradition or denomination. And so I just want to kind of give some background first, because this is a really important podcast and I want our listeners to hang in there because it really does impact them. Why does this issue that we're going to talk about that impacts the Anglican Church even really matter or Christians should care about? Now, I should tell everyone that newsworthy things keep happening that are important to everyone. For example, the New York Times recently covered the Southern Baptist Convention meeting in the summer of 2023 and their issues with female ordination. So I do think these news items have wide application. So why don't you tell us why this would matter to other Christians in other traditions besides Anglicans?
That is a good question. As a part of at least in the United States, a smaller denomination, Anglicans have been kind of the stepchildren of the evangelical world. A lot of people think that they are sort of Catholic, and so there's been a lot of mistrust between, or maybe not, just not understanding what Anglicanism or the Anglican way is. And of course, there's always been people who have been fascinated by the Anglican sort of version of Christianity, and often will stop it in the Anglican Church on their way out of maybe a Baptist situation, on their way to, say, an Orthodox or a Catholic church. It's kind of a resting place before they keep going. But there are millions of Anglicans around the world. It's a bigger church in Africa than some of the other, behind Catholicism, of course. But I think in the United States, what's happened in the Anglican world is worth paying attention to because for two reasons. One, we've often gone ahead and done things maybe the wrong way before other churches have tried that way. So the Anglican world has been rocked by issues of sexuality and progressivism and theological liberalism before those issues have hit, say, the Southern Baptists or even Presbyterians, Methodists. All those churches are dealing with what we dealt with two decades before, and even before that, 100 years, we've been really dealing with these issues. So if you want to know kind of how things work and what happens or potentially the pitfalls are in Christianity, looking at what's happened historically to the Anglican Church and the theological issues that are there is worth it as a cautionary tale. Second, I think there is a resurgence in the United States, an interest in Anglicanism, and a lot of people who are fleeing other denominations are now kind of finding refuge in my church, the ACNA, which is an interesting phenomenon because I grew up, again, as sort of the person to be suspicious of as an Anglican and, you know, maybe a World of Baptists. now a lot of Baptists are thinking, oh, well, the Anglican Church has, it's historic, it's beautiful, it's got everything we thought we didn't need, but now maybe we think we need it. And so it's growing, our church is growing, and it's again dealing with some of the issues that we already dealt with 20 years ago or 50 years ago. And so there's a freshness about our controversies, a relevance that I think pertain to the whole evangelical world in the U.S. And then, of course, to understand Christian trends across the world, which is also very, very important, how Christianity is shaping world issues and what kind of flavor Christianity has in different parts of the world. The Anglican Church has a lot to say about that. And so I think it's small, but it is very relevant. And I would encourage people to look at what we've dealt with, where we're going, what we're thinking about, because we're in a cautionary sense ahead of the trends sometimes. And we're peculiar. People are interested. Christians are increasingly interested in what's going on in Anglicanism in America. And so people should be cautious about and look at what we really are saying before they leap in or make a change from one denomination to another.
Well, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the history of Anglicanism and its roots, of course, in the Church of England. And I think for many evangelicals, church history is like the Book of Acts and then their local church, you know, that was founded in the 70s or something, you know, the Jesus movement or something, or the Reformation. You know, we think, oh, the Book of Acts, the Reformation, and then the church now. So there's not a lot of rootedness in history for a lot of Christians. They just haven't given much thought to the history of the church. So could you give us a little bit of an overview of where Anglicanism came from and maybe just a brief history of the Church of England?
Well, that's always my favorite question. Somebody recently pointed me to a new musical, Broadway musical, I think, about Henry VIII's wives that I listened to clips. I haven't seen it. I don't know that it's sort of a family-friendly show, but I do think that most people probably would watch that Broadway musical and think, well, that's what it is. It began with a divorce. Henry VIII was a really bad man. And then there is the Church of England. Of course, the Queen of England recently died, and there was the coronation of King Charles. And that sort of puts Anglicanism on display, the Church of England. And we have beautiful liturgy and an ancient prayer book. But it is sort of anachronistic. It's something nice to look at, but then you wouldn't probably live that way. That's probably, I would say, the popular version of Anglicanism that I run across amongst people that I even know and love. But Anglican Christianity began much farther back than the Reformation. Pope Gregory sent Augustine or Augustine, not the famous one from North Africa, but the other one, to England to evangelize the Britons in the 500s. And he was the first Archbishop of Canterbury. And so English Christianity, which was, you know, the whole world, much of the world at that point was probably what we would call Catholic now, had its own flavor. It had its own customs and traditions within Christendom at that time. And it's worth studying in its own right, just the middle period between the very early Christian church and when, by the time we get to the Reformation, which is probably what most people would think of with the Church of England or C of E. And so that's when you do come across Henry VIII, and he was notorious for having many wives, for being a bad man. But in the beginning, he wasn't bad. He was a good Christian, a good Catholic. He had political issues. At the time, he was married to Catherine, and of course, they did not have a son. And that caused had political ramifications, theological ramifications for the Church of England, for Christianity in Europe. But Henry was interested in some of the Protestant writings that were going on at the time. And his archbishop was Thomas Cranmer. And Cranmer became what was our reformer. And so we really don't look to Henry and his theological view of the world so much as we look to Thomas Cranmer, who wrote our Book of Common Prayer. And there's he wrote one in, I think, 1547, 1548. And then our official book that kind of roots and shapes the whole communion around the world is the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. That's recently been reissued by IVP. And there's a really beautiful copy of it that's been, it's just very user-friendly if anybody's interested in the root of our expression of Christian faith. And also, so Cranmer fashioned this book that is excessively beautiful. It when you join it with the King James Version of the Bible, you have a Christian faith that has really shaped modern English, even in our secular world. A lot of what we depend on as English-speaking people comes out of these two books, the King James Bible and the Book of Common Prayer. And but then he also wrote what are called the 39 Articles, which we don't have like a Westminster Catechism or something like that, but we do have these 39 Articles of Religion, which define who we are coming out of the Roman Catholic world. And so they're kind of peculiar. They address things that are very relevant at the time, like when there's an article on baptism, there's an article on the Eucharist or communion. But then there's some articles about the Pope and whether what grace is and how to be saved. So those articles of religion are, again, they do shape and define still most Anglican churches around the world, including my own local congregation. Anybody who's joining us has to take a class in the 39 Articles. And if you want to be in leadership, you have to really agree with them in kind of a formal way and convictionally. So Cranmer was a fascinating person because he was he really did have the conviction of his Protestant faith. He believed in the Word of God. He believed the scriptures should be read publicly in church. So we have morning and the evening prayer, which came out of the Benedictine tradition. Our daily office is grounded in the shape of the Benedictine life, which is really interesting and very ancient, but again, very fresh for people who pick it up and try to follow that rule or that order. And he believed that the scriptures were sufficient. He kept a lot of language from older traditions that I think other Protestant groups kind of jettisoned, maybe. And what another important thing to note about Anglicanism is that it's not, people call it the middle way. A lot of people think it's the middle way between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, Protestantism. It's actually the middle way between Calvin and Luther. So it has some interesting flavors of sort of Presbyterianism or Calvinism, but also some Lutheranism. And so you get Anglicans who sort of lean one way or the other, even today. And then through our history, of course, we had what emerged as an Anglo-Catholic kind of expression of Anglicanism. And those kinds of people feel very much, much more Catholic and often do just go all the way back to Rome. And there are services, there's sort of high church, which is a lot of what people call bells and smells. There's low church, Reformation kind of feeling churches. And they all, you know, emerged out of the turmoil of the Reformation. And wherever you go in the world, you're going to find one kind of expression of that centered, or, you know, people prefer one kind of way or another, but there is this underlying common ground around the prayer book. and the articles. And then overlay that, there's an English sensibility about Anglicanism, an understatedness, I think, that people still find really helpful. Even those people who are more of a charismatic leaning, when they come into the Anglican church, it's very much tempered. It's not sort of full-blown charismaticism that you might find in other kinds of traditions. So it's still relevant today, and that only gets you, that doesn't really include that what happened is England colonized, Britain colonized much of the world and took the Church of England with it as it conquered various lands. When the empire sort of receded back to its native shores, the Church of England churches that were in those places continued on, but became locally governed. So there are Anglicans around the world, in Indonesia, India, all over Africa, South America, of course, the United States, everywhere where England had a colony, there's some kind of expression of Anglicanism. And that's what's called the Worldwide Anglican Communion. When you talk about worldwide or global Anglicanism, it's those churches that became independent from England as she gave away her colonies, gave them back control, but also still have a spiritual connection and an ecclesiastical institutional connection to one degree or another to the Church of England. So it's an interesting church. I know other kinds of expressions of Christianity had a similar kind of transformation, but we do have a very international kind of feel. Most Anglicans now are found in the global South, in Nigeria and East Africa and India, rather than in England or America.
If you are a subscriber to the Postmodern Realities podcast, you've noticed that we've had a whole bunch of short episode pod blasts that have come out towards the end of June. And I just want to point your attention to the pod blast called A Fond Farewell, Not a Goodbye. That is a must listen to. It's very brief. And we have a written version of that in the articles section of our website, equip.org. So I want to point you to that about some big news for the Christian Research Journal. And I want to ask you that you would subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already done so, and also tell a friend about the podcast. And of course, as always, you have an opportunity to tip us to help us out with producing this podcast, which is weekly, and also it accompanies with a weekly new article at our website, equip.org, as well. And how do you do that? Well, you go to our website, equip.org, and you click on Journal, and you'll see Postmodern Realities Podcast. Please click on that at any landing page for any of our 348 episodes. You'll find a link where you can tip us. So now back to our conversation with Anne Kennedy about this big news and its impact on the Anglican Church.
Well, one thing I do want to ask you as we kind of give some background to our discussion so that people can understand why it's important is I would like you to give us an overview of Anglican church government, because most Christians, evangelicals in the United States, are part of independent churches that are not connected to other churches. I mean, myself, I am in a Reformed Presbyterian, not mainline conservative denomination, and we do have church governments and we're all connected together, but that's not something that's maybe the norm for a lot of evangelicals since, you know, I mentioned earlier the Jesus movement of the 1970s. Everything's a lot more loose and there's a lot of independent churches that people attend that aren't related to other ones. And so if you could just give us a overview of Anglican church government too, which over the years, I've gotten to know Matt and Anne, and I wasn't familiar with it at all either. And so it's been a learning experience to understand how their church functions. And that is really foundational to the rest of our discussion.
Anglican church government is a little more complicated. For instance, it's definitely not congregational. There's no sort of a democratic view of how a church would function. So we have the threefold order of ministry. We have bishops, priests or presbyters, deacons, who minister in the church, and then the laity. So a bishop is an interesting kind of church office because as overseer, the bishop, this is what plays into our discussion as we go forward, a bishop represents or is a bishop for the whole church. So a priest or a presbyter would be ordained in a local office for a particular diocese. He would be underneath the bishop. His life and manner of living and his doctrine don't necessarily pertain to the whole worldwide Anglican communion. So you can have a deacon or a layperson or a priest commit some kind of grave error theologically, doctrinally, or even in a manner of life, and it would be very bad, but that person would be put out or disciplined by the bishop, and then that would be fine. It would be locally managed. But a bishop is a bishop for the entire church. So every bishop in the Anglican Communion, especially when they gather together in synod, what they believe, how they live, is of utmost importance for the whole communion. So then each local congregation is governed by, at least in the United States, sort of, and I think in other parts of the world, it's called a parish council, but there's a priest or presbyter, pastor, and then there's usually a vestry. In the U.S., it's called a vestry, and that's because that's the room where you put on your vestments. The vestry would meet in the vesting room, and so they became known as the vestry. They would govern the finances of the church. The priest or pastor would govern the order and spiritual life of the church and would have a supreme authority over what was preached and what hymns were sung and how the liturgy would unfold. And then there's also the bishop who exercises spiritual and practical oversight over each congregation. So it's interesting, if you wanted to get rid of your pastor for whatever reason, the vestry could call in the bishop and there would be some kind of conversation. A pastor could be removed by the bishop, but a priest who is having a hard time with his vestry could appeal to the bishop, and the bishop could come in and lecture the vestry. So there's kind of a sense of balance between the different realms of authority inside of a congregation. And then at a diocesan level, the bishop, you know, he visits all the churches. They have to gather in local council at least once a year to do business. And then the bishops gather in synod as well, or some kind of convention. And then around the world, that's sort of by province. Each church in each location is called a province, and it has what's called an archbishop or primate, which a lot of people think that that's funny. It sounds like primate, like a monkey, but it's not. It's a bishop, the archbishop. And those archbishops or primates gather together, again, in synod or primates meetings, and they work together. They have spiritual communion with each other. If they receive communion together and worship together, then you would say that they're in communion with each other and their provinces are in communion with each other. And that's of utmost importance to Anglicans. We're not autonomous. We want to share spiritual communion with each other across time and space and across provinces. And so a lot of the issues that we've had have been strange. I think you don't just say, okay, well, we're going to leave the Episcopal Church, for example, and go off and set up next door. You have a problem of authority if your bishop does something that is not in keeping with the life and doctrine and ministry of the church. Then you have sort of a spiritual vacuum. You can't just set up next door. Anglicans can't conceive of life like that as an independent church. You have to have a bishop. You have to have somebody else come and help you and be your spiritual leader. And so a lot of the theological issues that we've had and progressive and liberal issues that have come into the church have come down to the very nitty-gritty issues of who is whose bishop. Can you have two bishops in one place? What happens when one bishop is denying the resurrection and another bishop isn't? And a lot of the details and politics of those kinds of questions became paramount for us in the last 25, 30 years.
So I want to ask you a little bit, just really quickly, about some terms you used that people might not be familiar with. You said the word diocese. What is that? And you also said the word synod. And then you were mentioning different parts of the Anglican Church, that there are more Anglicans, you know, in the global South than maybe in Western countries. So what does the term worldwide Anglican communion refer to? And then when it's using that word communion, what does that mean? What are the instruments of communion? If you can explain some of those things to us, that'll help us continue to lay the groundwork of why some of these issues are important. And I do want to let our listeners know that Anglicanism is one of the largest branches of Christendom. You know, it's probably behind the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, and certainly has this long history. So all of this is really important to every Christian, frankly.
Yes. So a diocese is of all the churches that are under one bishop, or maybe he might have an assistant bishop with him. And traditionally, those dioceses, that a group of churches, would be locally oriented. So, for instance, it's very similar to the Catholic Church. Where I live, there's the Catholic Diocese of Central New York, and it's all the churches that go from Syracuse down through to my town in Binghamton, and then maybe a little bit up towards Watertown or something like that. So that's a geographical grouping of churches underneath the authority of a bishop, and they would have to gather. The bishop would call a synod or a convention, a gathering, probably once a year, and meet with all of his clergy. He would visit each congregation during the year at least once, or maybe once every 3 years. And then he would gather the clergy for a business meeting and a spiritual, you know, encouragement and counsel. But in the Anglican Church in North America, we've allowed for there to be not just geographical dioceses, but what are called affinity dioceses. So actually my church is a member of a diocese that spans the entire United States, but we have other Anglican churches near us who are in other dioceses. Actually, they have different bishops come because we are organized more theologically around some Reformation principles and what our particular bishop has come to espouse theologically. So we're an affinity diocese, and that's a little bit of an anomaly. Most dioceses around the world are geographically based. And so then the dioceses that make up a province, all the different bishops in, a geographical location, such as the United States, would meet together and share communion together, and they would make decisions, business decisions, theological decisions together in council, in what might be called a synod or a convention, or, you know, whatever one name you want to give to it. They meet together, and that has real implications for their life, you know, on a local level. What we do, we have to pay attention to what the bishops say in council together. And then, you know, there's a kind of conversation between those two different groups. We relate to each other in our communion that way. The Worldwide Anglican Communion is all the member provinces that arose out of the end of the British Empire. So there are, I always get the number wrong. I think it's 37 or 38 Anglican provinces around the world, from Indonesia to Africa to South America. For instance, the province of the Southern Cone is Argentina, and I think one, maybe another small country. Chile has an Anglican presence. And those provinces, those Anglican churches in each country with their archbishop are connected to each other in a meaningful way, a practical way, through their councils, their synods that they hold together, and their common worship. And so it is huge. But what happens in Nigeria, for example, you know, it doesn't necessarily affect how we do things here in upstate New York, but in another sense, it does. What kind of theological decisions they make, how they live their life, whether or not they're undergoing persecution, which many Anglican provinces around the world are facing fierce persecution from Islam and other kinds of, you know, situations, that does have ramifications for how we live here in the United States and what our worship looks like. So we're not independent from each other. We're interdependent, maybe, is I think the word that's used more often. So I think I can't remember if you asked another question, if I hit all those sort of definitional issues.
I think I asked you about the instruments of communion. Did you mention that?
Oh, right. So there are, as the British Empire declined, four instruments of communion were adopted to keep the whole Anglican world connected to each other. And so one of the instruments of communion is the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, whoever he happens to be at the time. Right now it's somebody named Justin Welby. Then the second instrument of communion is something called the Lambeth Conference. So once every 10 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury invites every single bishop in the entire Anglican Communion to come to Lambeth Palace for 2 weeks of synod or council, where all the bishops meet together. This has been going on since 1850-something. The date is always, again, I'm really bad on my dates, but sometime in the mid-1800s, the Lambeth meeting came into being. And then the third instrument is the primates meeting together, the primates meeting. So there's the once every 10 years meeting of all the bishops across communion. There's thousands of Anglican bishops. But the primates meeting, the 37 or 38 or however many provinces there are, those primates, archbishops, are supposed to get together whenever called upon by the Archbishop of Canterbury to discuss communion matters and to worship together. And then the fourth instrument is called the Anglican Consultative Council. And that's made up of bishops, priests, and lay people. And it's supposed to deal with a lot of the financial issues of the communion and some of the more pragmatic day-to-day political issues of holding a worldwide communion together. And those four instruments are very important because they've been thrown into doubt based on what's been happening in the communion over the last 20 years.
Well, now I want to get to some of the bulk of our conversation in terms of the news. But first of all, I wanted to ask you about the Anglican Church in North America, and that's called the ACNA, Anglican Church in North America. That's its little abbreviation. And why was it founded and how was it founded? Because I think many Americans probably are confused. Are Anglicans and Episcopalians the same thing?
Yes, so the Anglican Church in North America is actually, the ACNA is both the churches in the United States and in Canada. So the ACNA is for both of those countries and not just the United States alone. So the ACNA came into being, again, this is a bit of a meandering down history lane here, but in the American church sort of early on had progressivism and theological liberalism infiltrate a lot of American churches. And that began to come to a head in the 1970s and 1980s. In the 1970s, there was a regular ordination of a group of women. So we began to have women's ordination in the 1970s in the Episcopal Church, which is the official Anglican expression in the United States of Anglicanism, has been the Episcopal Church. And the reason it's called the Episcopal Church is because during the Revolutionary War, you know, Anglicans in America didn't want to be called Anglican. It was politically problematic. And so Scottish bishops, the Scottish Episcopal Church, which was the Anglican expression in Scotland, sent bishops to the United States. And that's where we got the Episcopal Church from. So it was Anglican, but it, you know, kind of let go of the word Anglican for a couple hundred years because it was embarrassing. But in the Episcopal Church in the 1980s, and there just began to be this push for theological liberalism. And there were a couple of priests who were ordained who were in same-sex relationships, open relationships, and they were ordained anyway. And those bishops were not disciplined. It finally came to a head in 1998. A lot of the rest of the Anglican Communion worldwide had begun to notice what was happening in the United States, and they were unhappy with it. And so there was a vote taken at the Lambeth 1998 meeting of all the bishops of the world to sort of send a message to the American church that the question of homosexuality particularly was very important. And the church teaches, as the scriptures teach, that the only acceptable relationship, sexual relationship, is in marriage between a man and a woman, and that you cannot have same-sex marriage or clergy who are in same-sex relationships. Well, the American church, 1998, did not heed that warning. And so in 2003, the Diocese of New Hampshire elected and then ordained a man named Gene Robinson. Many Christians have heard of this person. Gene Robinson was in an openly gay relationship with another man. And the church ordained and blessed him. And that was really important because all the Episcopalian bishops in the United States had to get together and vote on that election. So New Hampshire elected him, but then every single bishop in the United States had to say yes or no whether or not they agreed with that election. And most bishops did, including our local bishop here in New York. They all voted to say yes to that. And that really threw the whole worldwide communion into, some people say, chaos, but it's because Gene Robinson was going to be a bishop for the whole church around the world, not just New Hampshire. And so at that point, many churches, it was a gradual unfolding of how this happened, began to leave the Episcopal Church. But again, as I said before, you can't do that. You can't just sort of go next door and be an independent church. If you're going to be Anglican, you have to have a bishop. So bishops from around the world began to rescue or provide Episcopal oversight for American congregations. So here in New York, the Anglican Church of Kenya took us as if we were part of their church in Kenya. And they took our congregation and our orders under sort of under their wing. And for a while, we were part of the Anglican Church of Kenya, even though there are, you know, seven other Episcopal churches around us here in Binghamton, we were suddenly in a totally different province, you know, geographically local, but spiritually not local at all. So that just continued until in 2008, finally, a group of bishops from around the world met in Jerusalem, and they made what we call the ACNA. They formed that province. They said, so it was bishops from Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, the Southern Cone, some parts of Asia. They met together in Jerusalem and said, we as international or worldwide Anglican Communion are forming a second Anglican expression or second province in North America. And so suddenly, you know, it was a matter of one meeting, there were two Anglican churches in North America, the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church in North America, the ACNA. It's a little more complicated because the ACNA was not recognized by the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so there's this sort of murky space where the ACNA is in communion with much of the worldwide Anglican Communion, but it's not in communion with the center of Anglican Christianity, which is the See of Canterbury. And that's important because we didn't really want to be in communion with the Episcopal Church. We left the Episcopal Church. They've committed such grave error that we would say they're not even Christian. They've abandoned the faith once delivered to the saints. So it was very messy. But all of those churches that were rescued by the world were given back their province, and we were given an archbishop, and that's how the ACNA came to be formed.
Well, all of this very in-depth background is central to a big news story surrounding an Anglican conference called GAFCON, which is another acronym for Global Anglican Future Conference. So what is GAFCON, and how is this particular conference organized, and how do things happen between meetings of this particular global conference?
So that meeting that I mentioned in Jerusalem in 2008, that was the first GAFCON meeting, the Global Anglican Future Conference. And when the conference is in session, when GAFCON is in session, once every 5 years, GAFCON is all capitalized, GAFCON is all caps. And that means that the GAFCON all caps meetings, those bishops from around the world who came together to form the ACNA, those are called GAFCON bishops, and they meet once every 5 years. So, and every other meeting is in Jerusalem. So the first one in 2008 was in Jerusalem, and the third one in 2018 was in Jerusalem. The latest one, 2023, met in Kigali, Rwanda. In between the meetings, every 5 year meetings, GAFCON continues as a movement. And so if you see the word, if you see GAFCON, but with the AFCON lowercase, it means that it's GAFCON just going on as a movement. GAFCON bishops, GAFCON provinces, GAFCON work is all continuing on, even though, you know, the conference isn't happening at that particular moment. The conferences, though, every 5 years are like a synod or a council. And those particular bishops that are GAFCON bishops make decisions together. Their communions, their provinces all make decisions together about communion matters and Anglicans in their provinces. The GAFCON bishops, some of them have been in communion with the See of Canterbury, although that's what happened in Kigali, is that's what we're talking about, is that that relationship was finally addressed clearly and definitively. What does the Archbishop of Canterbury mean? What authority does that see hold? And what is the Anglican Communion, basically, was the question. There's another group of global Anglican bishops, the GFSA, Global Futures, I always get that acronym wrong. Those bishops are now more formally joined with GAFCON bishops and came to our GAFCON conference and made decisions together with GAFCON bishops that pertain to the rest of the communion. So really the split that began to happen in 2003, the sort of, you know, well, that's the point at which we said the fabric of the communion had been torn. The ramifications of that tear are clearer, and the implications of that, what it means practically for Anglicans around the world, has become much, much clearer 20 years on.
So you attended this year's GAFCON, which was the fourth meeting in Africa, but what happened before this particular meeting?
So GAFCON 4 in Kigali was on the calendar for 5 years. They knew that it was going to be at this moment and this place. And everybody was just trucking along, getting ready for the conference. And then in January and February, the Church of England, C of E, bishops, really under extreme pressure from the English Parliament and some members of the English government, have been trying to make it possible to bless same-sex unions. They have wanted not to throw the communion into even further chaos, but they have also wanted to provide a way for English Anglican people to be in same-sex relationships and receive a blessing from the church. And so in January and February, and I think these prayers were actually being written last year, they began to write something called Prayers for Love and Faith, which is a long document. You can find it online. But it was an attempt to say that they weren't blessing same-sex unions, but they were going to bless the people who were in those unions, which is kind of an interesting distinction. Most of the world looked at that and said, that's not possible. You can't bless the people in the unions without blessing the union. And why would you want to bless the people in a union that is against the scripture, that God says he can't bless that union? He can't bless those people in that situation because that's not something that he blesses. And so those prayers for love and faith were accepted by the bishops, the House of Bishops in England. I think they took a vote, and I think a few bishops said no, and some abstained from the vote. But overall, it was a big majority of bishops in England accepted these prayers for love and faith. And then they were subsequently sent on to the wider synod, which includes clergy and laity. And I think they're probably still being debated at this point. But again, a bishop is a bishop for the whole church. And so any bishop who voted for those prayers implicated, again, the whole communion in that vote. And then to make matters worse, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said that these prayers were really useful and good and sent them forward to the synod, to the wider synod, to be considered. He didn't say, like, well, I think these are really bad. This is a bad idea. We shouldn't do this. Let's not disobey God's word. He really promoted them as if they were good. And so that suddenly shifted very radically what the Kigali GAFCON meeting was going to be about. All the other agenda was set aside. And at that moment, GSFA bishops rearranged their schedules so that they could come and meet in council, informal council, with GAFCON bishops to discuss what to do about the See of Canterbury itself.
So what were they trying to do when they met these bishops and communicate in a statement that would come out of GAFCON in response to this development in the Church of England?
So it should be said, as the British Empire receded to its shores, a lot of people are upset about colonialism today, and there's a vastly good number of reasons to be, continue to be unhappy about how England colonized much of the world. But in the church, in the Anglican Communion, there really hasn't been a deep bitterness about the See of Canterbury, the Church of England. In fact, there's been, I think I called it somewhere, sort of a residue of affection, of spiritual affection, that the See of Canterbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the provinces have been in communion, worshiping communion with each other. And so when the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, Justin Welby, publicly denied the faith, essentially, that was a really huge blow. It felt personal, I think, to many, many bishops, priests, clergy, laity around the world for Justin Welby to take that step, that public step. And so GAFCON and GSFA bishops wanted to meet and wanted to say that the Archbishop of Canterbury, it's probably been a long time coming, but it really definitely has now arrived. He doesn't have spiritual authority in the communion. He's abdicated his spiritual authority personally, just in his person, but also in his office as Archbishop. He's rendered the office of Archbishop of Canterbury useless for the communion. It's not an instrument of communion. It's an instrument of disunity. And the problem is that he controls the other instruments of unity. He convenes the primates council meeting and he convenes Lambeth 110 and he picks who gets to be on the Anglican consultative council. So it's a sudden and complete fall, the complete failure of communion work. So that's what needed to be said by this conference in Kigali. The bishops wanted a statement that was going to sort of, again, delineate some of the history and explain why the Archbishop of Canterbury and the See of Canterbury no longer are the center of our communion. He doesn't hold spiritual authority. And the word they used was to reset the communion on biblical foundations. So practically, it's hard to know what that looks like because there's only been one center for, you know, since the 500s, there's been one center of English Christianity. But now in this global era, who will hold that office and that authority of convening the communion and keeping the communion centered around Christ? So this statement, this meeting in Kigali, was to say that, first of all, that the See of Canterbury is not the center of our communion. We're resetting the Anglican communion. Our Anglican identity is not grounded in Canterbury any longer, which is a great and terrible thing to say. It was very heartbreaking to say that out loud, for the conference to hear and accept it. But it's a huge thing for Anglicans, of course, no matter where they are in the world.
I mean, this is why this is of interest to Christians of all traditions, because this seems to be a big shift since, you know, you're talking about the 500s and now it's the 21st century. So what are Anglicans in the United States thinking about this statement out of Kigali and GAFCON? You know, and what does the Anglican communion look like in the United States? You said earlier that some of the dioceses, instead of being founded more by geography, that they are kind of connected by theological conviction. So in dioceses that are connected by theological conviction, is everyone in the ACNA on board with this statement against the Bishop of Canterbury? Or, you know, is everyone embracing it? Or are there others that might not agree with some of the commitment that came out of GAFCON?
It's been interesting. I think our province is very new, for one thing. We've only been a province since 2008. And we've grown to one degree or another. And we are already divided, I think, in some of the same ways that some of the same issues and divisions that were occurring early on in the Episcopal, or sort of late in the Episcopal Church in the 80s and 90s, that eventually precipitated that split, are creeping back in into the American church. And there are a lot of people. I think that those people from the ACNA who attended the GAFCON conference were very happy about the statement that was put out, the Kigali commitment, and were grieved, of course, about the See of Canterbury. But I've, since coming home, I've seen a lot of people not even really understand what the Kigali commitment did. They read it and they didn't get the implications of it. They didn't really understand that, no, it really is, to one degree or another, it's kind of over. The Church of England is over as the convener of Anglicanism. It's not a church in the proper sense of that term. And so just like the Episcopal Church isn't a church, it's apostatized. It's formally left the bounds of Orthodox Christian faith. And so, you know, whatever happens to people, I'm sure there are Christians in the Episcopal Church, but there are also many, many people who are not Christian who go to church. So that's what's happened to the Church of England. And I think a lot of people in the ACNA are confused on that point. They don't understand what just happened. They don't understand why it was important. They don't understand why the ACNA even exists, that why aren't we all just Episcopalian? I've heard in different corners. And so I found that to be really interesting because we are such a new church and we were just formed by GAFCON. And now our archbishop had to reiterate when he came home again, no, we are a GAFCON church. We were made by GAFCON. We have to accept what GAFCON says. We're not free to chart our own course. We're connected to these churches around the world and we're not connected to Canterbury. So I think that this is going to be an interesting thing over the next 5 years before the next meeting, how this kind of shakes out. And I do think there's some really deep health in the ACNA. Most people are continuing to be really grateful, and it's mostly very faithful churches and clergy and bishops, but there are some divisions forming. And I think it's important for other denominations in the U.S. to continue to watch what happens in the ACNA, however small it is, to see how those issues are playing out, because I'm seeing it in other denominations as well.
Yes, I just mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I mean, major news media are definitely covering various different church conferences, just because I think maybe they're fascinated. Oh, you know, they see it as well. Are they getting with the times, or are they holding to something that's a little bit more old fashioned? And there's just not an understanding of why certain churches would hold to doctrines, because there's a rejection in our culture of biblical truth. Well, this has been pretty fascinating. What do you see happening in the future? I mean, I know you can't tell the future, obviously, but what do you see happening with this particular statement and kind of going forward from what happened in Africa?
Right. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I was really impressed. There was a contingent of English people at GAFCON, at Kigali GAFCON this time. And some of them have left the C of E, and others are hoping to stay in and continue to try to work to save individual churches, to just continue on in a very broken and essentially apostate situation. But, you know, when the church becomes Babylon, you can go on living there for a while and try to, you know, do ministry to one degree or another. And there's an immense amount of grief in England about what's happened, but it's fascinating. The West is rejecting Christianity sort of wholesale. And so Christians of every kind are going to find themselves in situations where they're profoundly at odds with the prevailing moral acceptability, which is important, because around the world, Anglicans have been persecuted, increasingly so in certain contexts, facing really violent and difficult situations around the world. And so our common communion together, I think, is being pared down. This is happening in every church. There's this kind of sifting going on. And those who really don't want to believe, there's no cultural virtue to be found in being a Christian. So you have to really be a believer to hang on. You're not going to get virtue signaling points for going to church anymore. It's interesting, here where I live in upstate New York, nobody just gets up and goes to church. In fact, when I go to church, or when I'm coming home from church and I run in the grocery store and I'm dressed up, people look at me like I'm a wicked person. So that's where we live now. And so we need to be okay with that. We need to accept our fate as outsiders and exiles, I think. And it's interesting for Christians in England, Anglicans in England, to be exiles in their own home is painful and difficult. But at the same time, I think it's an immense relief to see clearly how things really are and how it's been for a while. And that gives an immense amount of freedom. And I think Christians, Anglicans in particular, in the next decade, the next 5 years before the next GAFCON meeting, are going to experience an immense amount of freedom and joy and just an unburdening to be able to go forward in ministry and do evangelism and engage with people in the culture without this looming over them and kind of hanging over them and bogging them down, this endless debate about sexuality. There's work to be done in the kingdom of God. And that was so moving at GAFCON this last time, to be with believers around the world, worshiping as usual in the way that we do, and gaining strength and excitement to go out again into the world and preach the gospel and make disciples of all the nations. So I'm really encouraged. I'm excited for the next GAFCON meeting. I managed to go to Jerusalem twice now, and I'm really committed to being there for the third time if I live to see that day. And just being with the Anglicans from around the world who are not going to give in, and they are not going to apostatize, and they love the lost. They love the person who's confused about sexuality. They want to preach the word of Christ and rescue sinners. And so I'm excited. I'm so amazed to have seen this unfold in my lifetime and to kind of have been on the cusp of history as it's going forward. Some people said, as the conference was coming to an end in Kigali, this is the most important Anglican meeting that's happened since Cranmer decided to write the prayer book. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it really was an immense thing to have happened for the Anglicans of the world to say to the Archbishop of Canterbury, you have left the faith. It took immense courage, and I'm just amazed, and I think that God is really working a good work.
That's an exciting and encouraging conclusion to our conversation, because I think a lot of Christians would say, well, what a downer. I mean, you know, this long history of Christendom is, you know, in this pile of apostasy in the Church of England. And but yet you've looked at to see what the Lord is doing, what the Spirit is doing, and how the true church is prevailing and standing up against heresy. So that's a very fitting conclusion. Well, on a much lighter note, it's summer right now. So Anne, summer desserts, are you team ice cream or team s'mores?
Oh, team ice cream all the way.
Well, thanks Anne for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 348 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy. She has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called Despair and Hope in the Anglican Communion. And you can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.